I am Charlie Bennett, and this is the North Avenue Lounge. Welcome to the North Avenue Lounge. I'm going to use this introduction as a sound check. Hello, Shannon.
Hi, Charlie.
I'm glad you're back.
Thanks.
What have you got going on for today's show?
Today we have two fantastic guests. That's the last time I'll use the word fantastic, I promise.
Aw.
That's Shannon's favorite word.
Today we have Topher Payne and Johnny Drago, two wonderful, last time I'll use the word wonderful, I've been shamed for my expletive.
Those are really great words.
I know. But I have this bad habit of saying fantastic and wonderful to affirm my guests at the end of their great speeches.
She's going to start saying good job.
I just don't think we should
answers.
Be limiting her superlatives in the first 30 seconds.
Should have brought a thesaurus.
Tremendous.
So that was Topher first.
Yes.
Say hello.
Hey.
And then Johnny second.
Hi.
There we go. Okay, I think you are all leveled out. Shannon, take it away.
Great. So Topher and Johnny are well known all around the Atlanta scene for being playwrights, actors, writers, extraordinaire. Welcome, guys.
It's great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So we have had a little icebreaker in our back and forth here, but I like to start the show with an icebreaker. You guys are theater makers. What's one of your favorite icebreakers or theater games that you like to start the show or start your work together with?
Oh, Johnny, you're going to have to take this because you know how I feel about theater games.
Topher doesn't like passing invisible energy balls.
I do
back
not.
And forth.
I do not want to find my beat.
You know, one of my favorite theater games, it's so basic, is just to play a lively round of Duck, Duck, Goose.
Oh, nice.
Get the body going, get everybody waiting in that sort of panicked, you know, prepared state.
Yes, you have to get up and run around.
And then you have to get up and run around, yeah.
I love it. So we're all still 5 years old at heart. That's fantastic. Well, another purpose of the icebreaker at the beginning of the show is just to help us make ourselves say words that sometimes people don't say in everyday life. And so there's one word in particular I know we're going to say in this show.
I hope it's wonderful.
I hope it's fantastic.
No, but it starts the same with the same two letters.
Oh, gotcha. You're talking about the show that I won the Jean Gabriel Moore Playwriting Award for.
Yes. So help me say that word.
The title of the show was Angry Fags.
Yes. Okay. So I have to be able to say the word fag today.
It's really weird because I swear, and it seems like such a distant memory, but there was a time when that word was difficult for me to say, and then I had a show to promote. But the purpose behind the title was both an enticement and a warning that the conversation in the show was going to be very direct. And the reason I went with it is because angry fags sounds like a punchline, you know, what they do, hold you down and do your hair. And the whole kind of story of the play is that these men feel that as gay men, they are seen as less than men. And that their masculinity is challenged by perceptions caused by their sexuality. And so we just wanted to throw it out there. And now I have a plaque on the wall of my dining room that says Angry Fags in gold embossed letters. And it's a weird job I've got.
And Johnny, you acted in that show.
I did, yeah. I got to be a part of that show from the workshop process and help to create and originate that role. And actually, we were just talking the other day, yesterday, I guess, about how exciting it was, you know, to walk into Little Five Points and to see the phrase Angry Fags
on a marquee.
In the middle of everywhere, you know, busy street.
It got Instagrammed a lot.
It did, yeah. And I think that also was really powerful.
Yeah. And yeah. I think it was empowering for the audience as well.
Absolutely. I took my gay boyfriends. We had a blast. And we talked about it. And it was a very empowering show.
we wanted to provoke a conversation, and both in the positive and in the negative, mm-hmm. I think we absolutely did. And that's what good theater should do.
Mm. So, Topher, let's back up a little bit. Let's talk about you and your life and career. Where did you grow up, and how long have you been here in Atlanta?
I grew up in Kosciuszko, Mississippi. And
where is that?
That is about an hour north of Jackson, about an hour south of Tupelo. It's on the Natchez Trace. It's the birthplace of Oprah Winfrey. And I grew up just down the street of what became Oprah Winfrey Road when Kosciuszko decided to take ownership of her history there. And then went to boarding school in Connecticut briefly. And then Idyllwild Arts Academy in California for 2 years, and came back to Mississippi, spent a year at a theater there doing an internship, and then came to Atlanta when I was 19, and I've been here ever since.
Wow, okay. So have you always had art in your life? And if so, what were your influences?
Storytelling has always been, it's certainly a very strong tradition in my own family. You know, if you want to know who a person is, listen to their stories, listen to the narratives that they give about themselves, and what they're volunteering, and then you can start digging deeper. And, but telling stories was how I always made sense out of the world. From the earliest points, from when I was 5-6 years old, writing in the perspective of another character was how I made sense out of another person's perspective. And that maintains to this day. I mean, I'll have arguments with my husband where I sit down and write out his perspective. Because until I see the words on the paper, that's how I grow in empathy. That's how I developed compassion for others. And so it makes me a better person. And then I finally found a way to start making money off it.
Were you encouraged to do that in small town Mississippi?
My parents absolutely encouraged me to do anything that kept me out of trouble. I was a weird kid. I was absolutely a weird kid. I was not designed for a Mississippi town of 7,000 people. I had a family who believed I was onto something, but they were as confused and kind of bewildered by what the path I was going to take would be as I was. And so we just started taking stabs in the dark, which is how I ended up in Connecticut and then California and then living on my own at 17. They knew that the path I would take would be different from theirs. They were married at 19. And so because of that, we all discovered what I was supposed to be doing together.
So you had cancer at a very young age.
Yeah, I was diagnosed 6 weeks after my 21st birthday. And that's how I spent my 20s.
Mm. Tell us more about that.
Oh, gosh. Well, it's an awkward thing because, you know, when you spend... I spent about 7 years of my life off and on and completely without warning having surprise recurrences. And you look back on it and it does, I feel like I was in an abusive relationship with a disease. The lessons that I learned from it, certainly were the value of now. You know, people say, you know, oh, you're so prolific. And, you know, I write right now and try to get words out right now because I am very aware that there are no guarantees on how much time you have. So I'm grateful that I had that lesson at an early age. It definitely required me to grow up in very specific ways. And it makes me value relationships and also recognize the end of relationships a lot more clearly. And otherwise, it was just a lot of time in antiseptic environments.
And you turned that into a play.
I did.
And you killed yourself off in your play.
Yes, I did, because that's what you're afraid of. When you're dealing with a chronic illness, the fear is that the illness will win and you will somehow lose, and that the world will continue without you. And I think particularly at 23, when I wrote Relations Unknown and was going through my second round, that was the fear that I had to grapple with, was what will the world be like without me? And so I wrote a semi-autobiographical piece. And then at the end of the first act, I killed off the character based on myself and let the story continue without him. And he had an impact on some people. And for others in the play, their stories continued entirely independently of his influence. And you make your peace with that. You find that you're part of a much larger story that was going before you came into it and will continue after you're gone. And so it was a tremendous gift in that regard.
You've said, you refer to yourself as prolific. You've written a lot of plays in that time now.
I write a lot, yes.
And you've had every play you've written produced?
So far.
How many is that?
That's 15.
In how many years?
In 17 years.
That is a lot of writing.
are each of those plays you working something out, or were any of them?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, because you're going to be devoting anywhere from 6 months to 2 years of your life to the development of a work. And so if it's not a question that is that essential to you, if the quality of your own life is not riding on you figuring this out, then you're really wasting your time.
And you have produced plays both in Atlanta and outside of Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. Or other folks have.
Yeah. Yes. you have a fabulous series, the Lake Bottom series.
Yeah, that was developed through the State Theater of Georgia, the Springer Opera House. I had toured with a production of Greater Tuna for them as an actor, and they gave us the opportunity to audition for their upcoming season. And it was a special audition because we were going to be out of on the road when they were having their generals, and our
you'll have to explain that.
Oh, sorry. General auditions, meaning when they invite the public in, everybody does a 2-minute monologue and maybe 16 bars of a song. And so they'll do that for 2 days straight of just people coming in the door. And our dressers on the tour, who were responsible for our costume changes, were also actors. So they gave us the chance to audition for the season. And I had everyone audition with something I wrote because I wasn't interested in auditioning as an actor. I wanted them to see my work. And that led to a commission from the Springer with Lake Bottom Proper. And then its prequel set 80 years earlier of Lake Bottom Prime.
Wow. Most recently, I saw The Only Light in Reno up in Roswell, which was also a very good show, also starring Johnny Drago. And what are you working on now?
Working on a love story set in the world of fish fans on tour. Wanted to explore the story of what it means to really be devoted to something and kind of the...
That's Fish the Band.
Fish the Band.
Yes.
Kind of the... yes. I mean, they may also enjoy fish.
Uh-huh.
but the idea of people that followed Grateful Dead or followed Fish or followed, you know, String Cheese Incident from location mm-hmm. to location to location, and having that level of devotion to something that brings you joy... just seemed like a natural tie-in for a love story.
So I have to ask, are you a jam band fan yourself, or are you taking on something that has no connection to your life?
I married one, and...
So you're working out somebody else's stuff this time.
My husband toured with Fish for several years in his early 20s, sold burritos on lot, and that's always been this kind of mysterious story for me. Because now he's has a corporate gig, and but in exploring that more and more and getting to know the music more and more, I wanted to know him better. Certainly, any love story I write comes from that place. And as a result, and I just started in 1986 with Fish's first demo tapes and worked my way forward. And I have nothing but jam bands on my iPod right now.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a break for station ID.
To think about that.
You can follow Topher Payne at Topher Payne on Twitter and see his website at topherpayne.com. Thanks. We're going to take a break. Thanks.
Your friends here at WREK invite you to tune in every Friday at the midnight hour for Atlanta's only heavy metal program, Wreckage. Since 1984, we've ruled the night with an eclectic mix of old and new. That's Friday nights from 12 to 6, only right here on WREK Atlanta.
You're listening to the North Avenue Lounge on 91.1. Sorry.
The metal threw you off, didn't it?
It was the metal and the allergy medicine. Johnny and Topher spent the whole break throwing elbows at each other, so Johnny wants his turn.
I'm really dusted up over here.
It's your time to shine now. Where'd you grow up?
I am originally from Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh.
River City.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And when did you move to Atlanta?
I moved to Atlanta about 10 years ago this summer, either July or August, something like that. I went from Louisville to, I got my undergrad degree in musical theater and then a graduate degree in playwriting. And then headed down here to make my fortune.
Have you always had art in your life?
I have, yeah, absolutely. I think the impulse for playwrights or just writers in general is growing up with storytellers. My mom is from a small town in Holland, and so I got a whole lot of, like, Rosen Island, St. Olaf stories growing up back in Holland. We eat herring straight off the boat, that kind of thing. And then my dad was from, you know, the mountains of West Virginia, and so had a very folksy, sort of mythical body of stories to tell. And so I always grew up, you know, listening to these stories about other places and other times. And then in particular, I had an uncle who was, he's passed away now, but he was a visual artist, a painter, and he wrote poems and he wrote songs and he performed little sketches and things like that. And I always, you know, idolized him and knew that I wanted to be just like him. So.
Oh, and I just realized, Louisville, you had the Humana Play Festival in your backyard.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I was just talking about it the other day when I was telling my mother about Topher's award that he went to receive. And to my mother, that's just the local theater, you know. And so she was like, well, how come you never have anything in the Humana Festival? Like, it's much more complicated than
that. I'm working on it, Mom.
I'm working on it.
All right. So, but you have received some awards, some very significant awards here in Atlanta, the Metropolitan Theater Award for Kiss the Vampire.
That's true. Yeah. That was kind of early on, I guess, in my relationship with Topher and being pulled into the fold over at Process Theater and Onstage Atlanta. They asked if I had any, scripts they might want to look at. And I was working at the time on it was a romantic comedy about gay vampires, essentially.
right? One of those.
Because why not? Right. And that, yeah, that ended up winning the Matt Award, which Topher actually presented.
I presented. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a very...
Because I was the previous winner.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it was a very sort of lovely moment. Mm-hmm.
So the way you described that play, it was almost like you were just sort of playing around, like you were working in a genre. Do you approach them the same way that Topher does, or do you have a different mode?
I would say that Topher and I think we're equally probably disciplined. We both are people who are writing constantly. I don't necessarily know where your ideas come from. I like things that are really tawdry, and you know, I start from a place of like soap opera melodrama, you know, shocking titles, things like that.
When I hear you talking about getting an idea, you usually come from an environment. Like you're telling a story about
a place,
huh. You know, the world of trash, the world of
right.
Kiss of the Vampire. Even before you knew who the people were, you were talking about kind of the context and the world that was surrounding them.
Interesting.
And now you're doing the same thing with the new one.
Yeah. Mm. That's absolutely true.
Well, let's talk about your new one.
The new one being my recently completed script? Or the new
You're
one?
The one who decides what your new
one is. Oh, okay, yeah.
I don't know what's okay to tell.
I finished a new script a couple months ago that's sort of about, I'm calling it a Southern Gothic horror tragedy. It's kind of about Satanists in the South. Going along the lines of Shocking and tawdry.
And environmental.
And environmental, yeah.
Are you sure you're not from New Orleans?
Close enough.
Well, I saw Trash, and it was very trashy and fun.
Super trashy. And that script sort of sat in my ongoing working file for a long time, a couple years, before I really knew what to do with it. And then again, it was the Process Theater and asking kind of what do you have or what's next. And I was able to pitch Trash to Dwayne Morgan, who's the artistic director of Process Theater. I wanted to write a great role for him to play. I think he's a phenomenal, very sensitive and nuanced actor who very frequently ends up playing comedic roles. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to give him something that was a combination of high comedy, but also real tragedy and depth. And he totally, rose to the occasion under the direction of Topher, which was also another time that we were able to collaborate. Mm-hmm. And speaking of, the worlds of my play or creating the environments of my play, you saw Trash. The set was just absolutely insane, and that's
so
all
intricate.
to Topher's credit. He stayed up night after night. Mm-hmm. It seemed like through the night, organizing little mini vignettes of garbage and ceramic owls, and you could literally
couldn't figure
look at
out how to direct the
hours.
Play without designing the set.
I didn't get up during the intermission because I wanted to just
there was so much to
stare.
Look at.
Yeah.
And I could tell there were secret tunnels because you had actors pop up in one place mm-hmm. and then disappear and pop up in another place. So there was intricacies that you couldn't even see from the audience. So I thought it was one of the most fascinating sets I've ever seen.
It was, and it was such a credit to the cast as well, because they had to learn the intricacies of that environment so specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Because they all had specific hand props that they had to use, particularly in the movie recreation when everything is
right.
repurposed. And you'd have to remember that the pocketbook that you're using as a cell phone is underneath the McDonald's bag that's stapled to the wall.
Very
so
fun.
The thing that you do the most, is that the thing that you like doing the most? When you direct or write or act, are you best at the thing you like doing the most, or is it different?
Oh, I see.
I'm going to say no.
Because you sounded delighted talking about the directing, and you sounded very serious about the writing.
Yeah. I would never say I enjoy writing.
No.
Oh, no.
You
no,
enjoy
it's
having
a lot
written.
Of fun.
No. Writing is horrible, but being done with it is awesome.
Right. It's very satisfying.
The day you hand a script over and make it someone else's problem is such a good day.
So is acting pure joy?
It's a lot of work too. I mean,
yeah.
I moved to this town as a playwright, thinking of myself as a playwright. Having acted before, but very wanting to be very serious about writing. And as I've been sort of welcomed with open arms more and more into the theater community, and as I've gotten to work with Topher and got to act in his shows, and gotten to act more and more in general, it's a different kind of satisfying. Mm-hmm. I think acting feels to me like putting in an honest day's work. You really roll up your sleeves and you sweat it out, and you leave feeling like you have just done a monumental task. And so there's something really physically satisfying about acting that, when you're writing a play, you're sitting at a laptop and it feels a little bit, like an office job. You have to show up and punch the clock and do it, try to get this certain word count or try to get through a scene or whatever like that. But with acting, it's like rolling a boulder up the hill and you have to get it done every night. And
yeah, and in playwriting, you're sort of responsible for an ecology for a whole lot of people, whereas, yeah. With acting, you're sort of responsible to the whole, too.
Yeah, it's
and
part
directing
of an ensemble.
Would scare me the most of having to keep all of those details going.
Right.
With, I know that as a director, I'm picky I know that I'm really picky. If I can think of someone else that could do the script, then they probably should. And because you have to give up so much of your life, to be able to devote yourself to someone else's words and to bringing their words to life. And so it's gotta be a project that I'm really passionate about to be willing to make that sacrifice, because I really like my life. And to ask the people that I love to put everything on hold with me for a few months, it's got to be something that I really, really believe in. And I think that's true for me as an actor as well. I don't have an actor's bravery in just consistently putting yourself out there. I audition for things maybe once or twice a year, and it's when it's something that, when it's a very specific experience that I'm seeking.
Or when Johnny's written a part for you.
I don't know. He never has.
Oh. That hasn't happened just yet.
I am friends with so many playwrights. None of them write for me.
It's because you're too busy writing for them. So, Johnny, you also, you both dabble in fiction writing as well.
Yeah.
But Johnny more so than me.
Yeah. You've written, you won the Creative Loafing Fiction Contest.
That's right.
And you've written a book.
That's right. Yeah. I started self-producing a lot of plays, six or seven years ago, through the queer community and the Mondo Homo, community. And through that, kind of partnership, I, started writing with, my friend Max, who's now, a poet, E.C. Crandall. We started writing a blog together, which then turned into, you know, what else can we do kind of thing, and started writing this erotic novel called Executive Privilege, which was, you know, we were able to do a little bit of a book tour and, you know, do some readings and things like that of it. That was a great, great thrill. And then all of a sudden... I sort of looked around, and there was this literary community happening centered around Write Club and Hyde, ATL, and Vouched, and all of these organizations seen missing. And it was so exciting to look around and see this community of writers, everybody working very seriously, writing their faces off day and night.
Yeah.
And to get to be a part of that, and you know, certainly Topher ran the Syllabus show for a while. That was very exciting.
And
Naked City
felt like, you know, it's one of those, you know, 15-year overnight success stories where all of a sudden the literary community just gelled in a way that it never had before in the period of time that I have been here since 99.
Yeah.
And we had a posse, and everybody's work got so much stronger because of it. We were challenging each other in really, really exciting ways.
There's a performative writing scene in Atlanta now.
Right,
yeah.
Like readings and slams and theater.
You're
all
expected
at once
to be able to deliver your own work.
Yeah.
It is considered part of the necessary skill set that you have to be able to stand in front of a mic and sell your own writing. And if you achieve any degree of actual professional success, then that's going to be something you're going to have to do. You're going to have readings. You're going to go on shows like this. And so teaching all of us to come out of our little hovels and actually face the world and bravely present your writing turned out to be such an empowering thing. And because when you have to read it yourself, when you have to sell it yourself, you can't hide behind anything.
Right. And the other thing that's nice, I'm not a competitive person by nature. I just want to win. I don't want to actually compete. But the nice thing about something like Write Club is that you show up and you want to win. You want to win your round.
It's your A game.
And you bring your A game every single time. And if everybody is bringing their A game month after month after month, you know, everybody, you were just watching people for a period of the last 2 years or whatever get better and better and better, yep, and stronger in their writing as a group. And as, you know, I think posse is the best word.
You're listening to the North Avenue Lounge on 91.1. I'm Shannon Turner. We'll be back after a break.
The Subtle Genius Hour of Swag.
Have you ever wondered about your neighbors? Maybe wondered about the weird thumps and bumps or chants emanating from their apartment? Well, they may be followers of Bob.
So here's a deal you might not want to miss. Salvation or triple your money back.
Bob Dobbs came to town to set you free.
Reverend Ivan Stang says he'll offer an immense cash prize to anyone who can prove that Bob Dobbs is just a piece of clip art.
Now, at last, the step-by-step process is revealed. This is it, the only faith that promises action, thrills, success in sex and business.
Bob is great.
The Subgenius Hour of Slack. Saturdays at midnight. WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Repent! Quit your job! Slack off! And
pray for!
That was fantastic!
Whether you're a fan of classic icons like Mario and Zelda, or the new titans like Kratos and Master Chief, we play all the best video game music here on Mode 7, the ultimate show. Join us every Sunday from 6 to 7 p.m. and get your game on.
This is the North Avenue Lounge on 91.1 WREK. We're talking today with Topher Payne and Johnny Drago. So you guys clearly know each other very well.
Too well. Entirely too well. I wish I did not know him as well as I do.
How long have you actually known each other, though?
Oh, God. We should have an answer for that.
We should have an answer for that. Since, well, okay. So I remember first seeing Topher at an old working title event at the old theater that is in Decatur, that was in Decatur.
Uh-huh.
Where you turn right, kind of by the post office, and it cut off. What was that theater called?
I have no idea.
It's been like 8 years, 9 years ago. There was a working title event, and there was like a panel of local playwrights or whatever, and I went.
Neighborhood Playhouse?
Yeah, exactly.
You were at that thing?
Yeah, I was totally there. I was like fresh in town.
Oh, I got really mad at that panel. That's the thing I remember.
Yeah, a lot of things. I learned a lot at that panel.
I got really mad at that panel. Because there were playwrights that were just really throwing some dirt clods out there, and I needed to stomp them down because it was just irresponsible.
What does that mean, throwing dirt clods?
Well, it is a softened euphemism because we're on the radio. meaning I felt that if we were being presented as people who were trying to make our careers and were people who, for whatever reason, were being presented as aspirational, that we should give responsible advice. And I was just hearing some really, really bad advice on that panel. I can't remember any specifics. This has been years. All I remember is my white hot rage.
It's getting mad. Yeah. Hulk smash.
And, how long after you met did you start working to each other?
I don't know when we actually started having like a daily or like actual.
I mean, there must have been something that predated the first time you came in on Designing Women.
Right. I mean, we had to have known each other.
Yeah, I guess we knew each other through Quality People.
There you go. There you go.
Nice answer. And we haven't actually talked about Designing Women Live yet, so we have to talk about that.
Designing Women Live is a... We just finished it yesterday. There are literally 30 wigs in my car right now.
I'm still picking glue out of my eyelashes.
I'm following you to your car.
It is a fundraiser for Onstage Atlanta and the Process Theater Company. Process Theater produced my second play and then has produced, I believe, 6 or 7 of my plays since then. They've produced 2 of Johnny's. And Process exists for the development and promotion of Georgia playwrights. Onstage Atlanta is one of Atlanta's longest-running companies, and they've suffered from economic twists and turns just like every other company, usually involving what building they get to stay in. So they're in a new space this season over by DeKalb Farmers Market. Designing Women Live is the fundraiser that every theater prays they find, that they can bring back once a year, and it lands with your audience. Your audience gets excited about it. They want to be a part of it. They want to have the experience. And it is two episodes of the classic 80s sitcom presented live on stage with men playing all of the leads. And Johnny plays Annie Potts, and I play Dixie Carter.
I can't help but say fantastic.
Does it make anybody angry? Do you get people pushing back against that?
Never. If they do, they're not doing it loud enough.
Right.
What we get is, because we're not making fun of it, and I cannot express that enough, this is not a parody.
Right.
Of the work that these people did. 80s sitcoms lend themselves very well to stage adaptation because they were presented in front of a live studio audience. Linda Bloodworth Thomason was a really, really savvy writer. And she has a playwright's heart, I swear to God. And so it's a joy adapting these for the stage. And then at the first rehearsal, we always do the reminder because we always have new guest stars coming in playing the secondary and ancillary characters. And we always start with the reminder of the mission, never comment on it. It isn't funny watching a man in a dress who knows he's a man in a dress. What's funny is watching a man in a dress do everything he can to make you forget that he's a 6'2", 230-pound man. That's comedy. And the laughter that we get is, it's this laughter of recognition.
Right, yeah.
Where people delight when a line delivery matches their memory.
People try to say the lines along with it. They really remember the episodes.
Are you doing different episodes every year?
Yes.
Okay.
And I do. I tend to do one of the episodes will be a mashup of the plot from one episode and the plot from another episode combined, because a sitcom without commercials is about 22 minutes long. And so you can't offer somebody a 44-minute evening of theater. And, I mean, you can. And so
some people might prefer it.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. When they're bad, they're never short enough, are they?
Please tell me you've done the episode about the night the lights went out in Georgia.
I hear that speech in my sleep. I hear it when I'm standing in the shower. Poor Amanda Kuchar, who is a frequent collaborator for both of us. She's a brilliant actress.
Oh, yeah.
And she always takes one of the thankless guest star roles because she loves us and supports us. And she knows we'll keep trying to give her work. And she has been on the receiving end as the beauty queen that Julia is reading for filth for, I guess, probably more than 30 performances. She's had me screaming in her face. And from a distance, I'm okay in makeup, but up close, it is alarming.
It's shocking.
So how many projects total have you guys collaborated on?
Here we go.
Okay.
All right, Angry Fags, and he was with Angry Fags from the very first public reading, and then auditioned several times and won the role over and over and over again. I directed Trash.
Yeah. Only Light in Reno.
Only Light in Reno at Georgia Ensemble this past January. He played Montgomery Clift beautifully.
Yes, indeed. Another one of my gay boyfriend dates, just so you know.
I'm so my glad gay boyfriends we keep giving y'all nights
we
out.
Have a standing date for any project that you guys do.
Excellent. I love it.
4 years of Designing Women.
Yeah. Six iterations.
And then we've collaborated on various Write Club and Write Club adjacent projects.
Right.
And now we're trying our hand at writing something together, along with
Suhaila Elatar, another actor and playwright in town,
and a frequent collaborator for both.
Right,
she's fantastic.
She's
fantastic,
amazing. Yeah. And,
I want to come back in another life as her.
Yeah,
and so we wanted
deal.
To see what would happen if the three of us combined our voices and put something together. And we're having a lot of fun doing that.
Yeah. The idea being that we three are writing it together, to be performed by the three of us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Full-length play?
Full-length play.
Where will it be produced?
We don't know yet.
Oh.
We don't know how long this is going to take. We're in some uncharted territory.
Right.
We've had a lot of nights at Manuel's Tavern. Uh-huh. And yeah, so it's very, very exciting. And it's amazing to me that I've reached a point in my career where I have an artistic relationship with other artists that I would trust enough and who trust me enough to combine and throw all of our voices in the same carpet bag and see what happens.
Right. And to me, that's what's so wonderful about the theater community in this town as opposed to some other towns, or the literary community in this town as opposed to other places, is that, you know, that there is a sense of competition, but only with the idea that everybody grows together. There's not a sense of edging out the competition or freezing out the competition or being difficult, you know.
So the only time we really bash other writers, and of course that does happen, and because I know they do it about us, I mean, come on. another Topher Payne play, great. But the only time I feel that we ever sit around complaining about another writer is when we know that they are making the choice not to challenge themselves to do better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bringing your own, not bringing your A game is the only.
And I get mad. I get mad at what I perceive in my own little judgmental bubble, which I have no right to have, but what I perceive to be as wasting talent.
Mm-hmm.
And do you feel like you have the ability to actually challenge somebody in that way?
I certainly try to. I get in their face and say, do better, because they do it to me. You know, I tell people, you know, particularly when you take reviews into consideration, you should only have about three people in your life whose opinion can actually destroy you.
Who are they?
I don't think they know.
Okay.
So
I thought you were thinking of three specific people.
No, that's what Abraham, I mean. Yeah, no, keep in your mind three people in your life who, if they say that wasn't good enough, believe them.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I definitely have those people. And I'm not going to know. No, because once he knows, he's going
to
use
it. Oh, I don't want to know. Yeah, I have no business having that level of power.
But have people who you know can evaluate your work at that level. And then everybody else, be blessed elsewhere. You know, yes, they are entitled to their opinion, but you are not entitled to their opinion.
Those are very good words on a Monday morning.
So how do you choose a collaborator? How do you choose who you're going to go in with?
You find someone as stubborn as you.
And as talented and as driven.
Yeah.
To me, the drive is really important.
And I would say someone who has a similar aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think Topher and I have very similar senses of humor.
Yeah. But our writing is very, very different.
Yeah.
And if you throw, you know, using the example of what we're working on right now, you throw Sue Hyla into the mix, it's a completely different aesthetic. And yet we all laugh at the exact same things.
Right. Right.
Well, with that, we're going to take another break. You're listening to the North Avenue Lounge on 91.1 WREK. You're listening to Shannon M. Turner, Topher Payne, and Johnny Drago, and Charlie Bennett.
Hi.
You're listening to Boring Havanagila. For the best Jewish and Israeli music this far from the Holy Land, try Kosher Noise with your host, DJ Meltz, Monday nights from 7 to 8 p.m. And now back to your regularly scheduled program.
Hey, let's go to a show.
Why would we go to a show? We got perfect show right here.
What show? What show are you talking about?
New Force is on WREK Atlanta. It's all the best punk girl group psychedelic rock you could ever imagine.
That sounds like a great idea.
Yeah, let me find it. Oi, here it is.
This show is great. What did you say it was again?
is New Forces every Tuesday, 11 p.m., only on WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
I'm going to listen every week.
Me too.
This is the North Avenue Lounge. We're talking to Topher Payne and Johnny Drago. The boys were just complaining about how much their feet hurt from wearing heels all weekend long.
Shannon will sell you out.
See that bus coming before she threw us.
Yeah.
Which actually makes me think about, have you done drag much, outside of?
Why are you looking at me, Drago?
I don't know.
He's got drag in his name.
I had done one, just a comic, kind of one-off drag role one time. And then it was only really because of Designing Women that I started doing this.
Developing a skill set.
Right.
I have a odd side career as a male actress. it started with a 7 stages show called Wizard Pizzer in 2005. And then, for whatever reason, I just kept ending up in high heels.
Well, he's striking. He's striking.
I am difficult to ignore.
No, I mean, by striking, he'll hit you.
I definitely have a complicated relationship with that aspect of my career. But it led to me being able to play Auntie Mame. Which is one of the most satisfying experiences I've ever had as an actor.
I can imagine.
My God, to live in that mindset, seriously, it'll change your life. Look at the world through Auntie Mame's eyes will change the way you approach the world.
Yes.
And I got lighter, I got happier, I got much more optimistic.
Huh.
It was delightful and was this really, really necessary experience for me as a human to play Auntie Mame. My mom came and saw it, because they loved that movie. And it was just this tremendous growth experience for me as a human being. And so because of Auntie Mame, I no longer bemoan the blessing of my second career.
Everyone should watch Auntie Mame at least once a year, I think.
I know, right?
Well, the reason why I asked about drag is actually my show 2 episodes ago, we did a whole segment on drag in Atlanta. And
it's totally hot right now.
Yeah. Well, it's been hot in ways.
Well, yeah, it comes in cycles. But the current generation of queens, they're really redefining it, especially in Atlanta.
And drag plays such an important role in the gay community. And you guys are both gay.
And in theater.
I hope I didn't, just out you to anybody. What do you think it's like to be gay in Atlanta in this generation?
Just a simple question.
Yeah, right?
No big deal. Don't be asked to speak for yourselves or the whole generation or anything.
Well, I think, to me, Atlanta is interesting because it is the first stop for basically every gay kid who is escaping whatever town in the Southeast. It is New York City to those kids.
Yeah, it's Valhalla.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And so it's a very safe place, I think. I mean, mm-hmm. as Atlanta has its safety and unsafety, or like anywhere else or whatever. But I think to be gay, to walk down the street and hold hands, or to be dressed however you want, it's a safe place to do it.
Right.
Largely.
Mm-hmm. And Topher, you've made references a few times in this episode about being married.
Yeah.
You have a husband.
Yes, I do.
But that's not possible in Georgia.
Right, yeah. Georgia would disagree with that assessment.
Yes.
I found that out when I took my marriage license to the DMV to use as identification, and they said it wasn't an official document.
Mm-hmm.
We were married in Massachusetts in 2009, and as of this year, the federal government recognizes that marriage license, and I'm patient. We're both patient, and... there are some aspects of the tide of history that simply can't be resisted.
Well, the arc of history is long but bends toward justice.
Yes, it does. Isn't that a reassuring thing? And I've had wonderful moments. When we did the show at the Springer Opera House, I had the opportunity to introduce my husband to the governor and first lady and shake hands and be able to say, this is my husband, Tommy, which is a nice moment. And so, you know, I guess for me, the experience, I mean, because Tommy and I have been together since 2007 and so I don't think of it as being the gay experience for me as much as just, you know, the married experience. And because certainly talking to any of my married friends, gay or straight, we all have the exact same problems. We all have the exact same challenges and successes and joys. And, you know, I would say that being a homeowner is much more stressful than being a gay person.
There's a really nice segment of your website that is a video, a vlog, that is where following you guys
when
you got married, which is I highly recommend you guys checking it out. Let's segue over and talk a little bit about what it's like to be an artist in Atlanta. How do you feel about making your way in the world today and how it takes everything you got?
Well, cheers.
Would you like
to
take a break from all your worries? If we sing one more line, you have to pay money.
Well, I think it's kind of tied back to the idea of the gay community thing. There's so many people here, so creative. Everybody's working on something. Very many people are working on something, and, you know, boundless energy. And so, you know, there's lots of opportunities to plug yourself in somewhere or to get involved in a scene.
I mean, thank God for organizations like Working Title Playwrights, or for the Process Theaters Plays in Process, Peter Hardy with Essential Theater, companies that are ready and willing to embrace new artists in the community. I do think we have a responsibility. Atlanta has a reputation for being a very supportive community. You have a responsibility to maintain that, which means sometimes there's the attendant demon on your shoulder that you have to thump off and say, no, you don't get to go in that direction because that's not what we do here. And when I've had work produced in other cities, I've definitely gotten a different vibe from the community. And moreover, when artists from other cities visit us, it becomes very clear we're all rooting for each other to win.
Mm-hmm. But you both still have to have a day job to make it by.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that you struggle to be a working artist?
I have sort of emotionally struggled with it, but you know, I work a day job. I work at Emory. It's a great job. I love the people I work with. I work 9 to 5, and then the rest of my time is mine to make art or do whatever I want, which is really, really nice.
I mean, I think it's also very telling that I'm the creative director with True IT Pros, and I think it's very telling that we are here instead of there, that we have employers that make it possible for us to do both, and that they know what's important to us and support it. My boss, Robert Cole, I would not have been able to do what I've done since I started working for him in 2009 if I hadn't had the consistency of that support. And I still show up and try to do my job to the best of my ability.
Mm-hmm. Not every artist has that kind of support.
No, and it took me a long time to find a gig that I could achieve that balance with. You know, I have friends, particularly friends that work retail or work restaurant jobs. You take a couple of shifts off because you've got a callback and you may be out of a job. Or you have to maintain the shift and then you don't go to the callback audition and you lose the role.
Right.
And if you got to change one thing about the ecology of art making, particularly here in Atlanta, what would you change?
I would governments subsidize. I believe the arts are essential to the survival of a community. We are if you want to know what happened in the Salem witch trials, read a history book. If you want to know what it felt like, read The Crucible. And so art is necessary as if keeping the history of our species. And I think that that is worth a greater financial investment than Americans tend to place on it in general. It's not just an Atlanta or Georgia or Southern thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think I would tend to put an emphasis on, and Topher and I have talked about this recently too, the idea that criticism is an equal mm-hmm. component in art making and in an art making community. You know, and I think it's nice that this town is so supportive of our arts. I am suspicious that it's sometimes not as critical, or just that the dialogue isn't there. Now, somebody like Andrew Alexander, you know, is really to me the best at his job, because he not only, you know, critiques things in the negative sense, or, you know, this could be better or whatever, but then also really works to support and build up, you know, whether he's reviewing
I believe that he loves theater as much as we do.
Yeah, and you really get the sense that he's plugged in and wanting to help build the scene.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank you guys so much for being here today. We've been speaking with Topher Payne and Johnny Drago, two amazing playwrights, actors, and writers at large, writ large. This is the North Avenue Lounge. I'm Shannon Turner, and this is A Final Thought. Many people loathed Shakespeare in Love for its historical inaccuracies and pure schlock, but for English majors and drama geeks the world over, it was a film made for the tribe of outsiders and misfits to come together and bond over inside jokes and shared language. One of my favorite parts was when the play's producer captures the unfortunate Jeffrey Rush and threatens to put his boots to the fire because things aren't going well and it appears the play will not actually occur again. Mr. Finneyman, allow me to explain about the theater business. The natural condition is one of insurmountable obstacles on the road to imminent disaster. So what do we do? Nothing. Strangely enough, it all turns out well. How? I don't know. It's a mystery. For centuries now, our theater makers have been inviting us into darkened spaces and even into non-traditional places for the ritual that invites us to open up our dreams, our imaginations, our worldview, into someone else's lived experience. Great plays like A Raisin in the Sun and, well, anything by Sarah Rule and on have the power to transport us somewhere else and teach us something new. But for just as long, most of these artists have been making that magic on shoestring budgets, less than minimum wage, and no health care, or better put, through seemingly insurmountable obstacles on the road to imminent disaster. I'd like to think that in this century, with all the problems we're facing, and there are a lot, I mean, I learned recently that 85 people have more wealth than 3.5 billion people in the world, and that we have less time than we thought to fix our carbon emissions if we're going to stop climate change. With all that in mind, doesn't it seem like the very least we could do is support our artists a little bit better? Because at the end of the day, they are the ones who are helping us to dream that better world and making the one we live in currently better while we're in it. I'm Shannon Turner, and this is the North Avenue Lounge.
You've been listening to the North Avenue Lounge on WREK Atlanta. You can hear the show again at WREK.org/North Avenue, and you can hear this show and many more at NorthAvenueLounge.com. Thank you.